for years, the Hasidic community in Williamsburg and other areas of New York has been under attack. And very few people outside of those communities were aware of them. We just weren't reporting it.
From time to time on this podcast, we drop special episodes, topics that are meaty enough to warrant their own conversation, but not long enough to be a dedicated episode. It's what one of my favorite podcasters, Bill Simmons, calls free appetizers, free apps. It comes before the meal. It's not the entire meal, but it's on the house. So this one's on the house. Look out for a regular full-length episode, The Meal, to drop Tuesday. But until then, for this special episode, this free app, we have one of our regular guests, Brett Stevens, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the New York Times, returning for a conversation about cancel culture, anti-Semitism, and a new issue of a journal he edits called Sapir. More on Sapir later. As listeners to this podcast know, Brett came to the New York Times after a long career with the Wall Street Journal, where he was most recently deputy editorial page editor and, for 11 years, a foreign affairs columnist. And before that, he was editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. And prior to Israel, he was based in Brussels, also for the Wall Street Journal. Brett was raised in Mexico City. He earned his BA at the University of Chicago and his master's at the London School of Economics. This is Call Me Back. And I'm pleased to welcome back to the podcast for a special episode, Brett Stevens of the New York Times, of the Sapir Journal, and as we recently discussed, banned, officially banned, by Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. A very high distinction. Brett, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Okay, so I want to talk, I inhale Sapir, Sapir Journal, which is a new journal that you started and the Maimonides Fund backs, and it's this incredible collaboration between you and Maimonides. I'm a huge fan. I have the various issues here, and you can read it online, sapirjournal.org. There was the summer 2021 issue on power. There was the winter 2022 issue on aspiration. There was the spring 2022 issue on Zionism. I can go on and on. I actually have, like, you know, highlighted notes from some of these essays that I liked or wanted to use or reference, because you also collect, you basically collect a pretty interesting group of writers. But I want to talk about the newest issue, which just came out, called Jews and Cancel Culture.
Yeah.
So I guess first tell us what Sapir is, and then I want to talk about why you decided to do a whole issue on Jews and cancel culture.
Well, Sapir is a new Jewish quarterly whose subtitle is Ideas for a Thriving Jewish Future. So what we see ourselves as doing is providing Jews, particularly Jewish Americans, with not just arguments, but really prescriptive ideas for how to make different aspects of Jewish life more successful, to increase a sense of community and commitment and purpose and excellence to Jewish life. And I also am of the view that the best way to do that is to bring in writers of different perspectives, whether they're different religious perspectives or different political perspectives, so that we're really speaking to the broad Jewish family and not just the left-wing sort of dissent reading side of it or the right-of-center neoconservative side of it, but a broad spectrum of people. So that's Sapir, and every issue we publish it on a quarterly basis. Every issue is devoted to a single theme, whether it's social justice or continuity or Zionism or education or now cancellation. And we attack that theme from a whole variety of perspectives.
So the new issue on cancellation, what was the inspiration for this issue? Why did you think you needed to write it? And you wrote an essay for it called Jews and Cancel Culture, which Can you talk a little bit about that too?
Well, I think the whole subject of cancellation engages a set of deeply Jewish questions ethically and theologically. David Wolpe, the rabbi, has a wonderful essay tackling some of the theological issues. But it also engages, I think, a lot of Jews and people who are in professional life on a personal basis, because cancel culture has come knocking on our doors, in our organizations, in our universities, in our media establishments, and so on. And so we thought that this was a fruitful topic about which people have strong views and important views, and we decided to cover it.
And what you talk a little bit about, you know, we tend to we're not very clear, I guess, is my interpretation, on drawing a distinction between what it means to be canceled and what it means to live with consequences for bad behavior, but not totally canceled. So can you talk a little bit about the distinction and why it's important?
Yeah, I mean, look, Harvey Weinstein wasn't canceled. Harvey Weinstein was behaving in a criminal fashion, and he was not just fired, but he paid deep legal consequences. Another example I mention is Roseanne Barr, who tweeted about Valerie Jarrett, the former President Obama's former aide, in a manner that was sort of nakedly racist, and Disney fired her. Well, Disney has legitimate reputational interests in not having one of its premier talents speaking that way, and that's normal established behavior. That's not cancel culture. Cancel culture is a new, different set of attitudes about what is a firing offense, and the goal is not simply to discipline an unruly person. The goal is to establish a set of norms within organizations that are punitive and that advance ideological agendas. That's cancellation. So I spell out in my essay that cancellation is an action, it's a method, it is a mentality, it's a culture, and it's finally, it involves also capitulation on the part of managers who ought to know better and ought to know that there ought to be something between capital punishment and no consequences whatsoever when it comes to infractions that are effectively about political views or norms rather than professional conduct.
And you point out that it often is, you know, standards that are constantly changing that are impossible to keep up with. So,
right, you know, exactly. And that's one of the things that's terrifying about cancel culture, which is what was acceptable 5 years ago.
Or 5 weeks ago.
Or 5 weeks ago, yeah. Acceptable today. And by the way, if it is unacceptable, is the consequence going to be firing? Are there any warnings? Are there any steps along the way to disciplinary action? And are the penalties going to apply retroactively to behavior that happened when it was much more ordinary behavior? So that's a profound distinction, which is that cancel culture reaches into the past to discover behavior that might have been okay then, or at least not a firing offense then, and turning it into a firing offense now. And it's making organizational life, professional life, scary.
And it is, and another key distinction, it is most of it involves people, the accusers and the system that enforces, you know, that sentences one to cancellation is basically operating in bad faith. They're not actually trying to constructively engage the person charged. There's
no effort at achieving reconciliation, offering forgiveness. If you apologize in an organization that has adopted a cancel culture mentality, that apology isn't seen as a bid for forgiveness or an effort at a conversation. It's an admission of guilt, for which the sentence is always reputational ruin. And anyone who is working in most organizations, large organizations in the United States today, I think is afraid. There's just a pervasive fear in almost any line of work with which I'm familiar.
So now let's talk about rising anti-Semitism, which you've written about in your column. Most recently, you wrote a column about Kanye West, and you cite some pretty staggering data. It's out there. For 2020, the FBI reports that Jews, who constitute about 2.4% of the total adult population in the United States, were on the receiving end of 54.9% of all religiously motivated hate crimes. On many nights in New York City, Hasidic or Orthodox Jews are being shoved, harangued, and beaten. You talk a lot about this. The chief of the New York City Police Commissioner was recently in a meeting with some friends of mine who, she said, it's like unbelievable. You have these gangs of young people roaming the streets of Brooklyn who go out on a Saturday night looking to go beat an Orthodox and a Hasidic Jew. That's like they're out and about, like that's their recreational activity. It's something they have not seen anything like this, I mean, in decades, right? Since the early 90s. So, and even what they're seeing now is actually different than what they were seeing post, Crown Heights. But you say what we're going through now is one of the most underreported stories in the country. And you say, which itself is a telling indicator in an era that is otherwise hyper-attuned to prejudice and hate, I guess hyper-attuned to the need to cancel. And yet you're saying here no one's paying attention. And then Kyrie Irving, and then Kanye West happens. Do you think things are changing? Do you think people are paying attention?
I hope so. And I think that the media started paying attention because Kanye West is seen as a right-wing figure. Although his strand of anti-Semitism seems to be inspired by kind of Louis Farrakhan or the Black Hebrew movement,
Nation
which is
of
an
Islam.
Anti-Semitic movement. And so I think that has prompted some belated attention by the media. But I've been just shocked by so much of the coverage. Just to give you one example, after that hostage-taking situation in near Dallas in January, the FBI said, I think idiotically, I just think the agent in charge didn't know what he was talking about, said, well, we don't think this was an anti-Semitic attack, or words to that effect. Compare that to the way in which the same media, and then the media parroted that line from the FBI for about a week. Compare that to the way the mainstream media provided wall-to-wall coverage on anti-Asian attacks in the wake of that horrific set of massage parlor shootings in the vicinity of Atlanta a year earlier. So, when there are hate crimes against Jews, particularly if the hate crimes are not coming from people in MAGA hats, they tend to be dramatically, noticeably underreported or excused as a function of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or as a misguided retribution for Jewish behavior in mixed neighborhoods, like aggressive landlords or Jewish landlords or new Jewish neighbors who want to buy their neighbors' homes. So this itself is part of the problem. It's not anti-Semitism, but it's sort of anti-Semitic adjacent because it applies one set of standard to anti-Jewish hate crimes and another set of standard to hate crimes against other groups.
You also cite other examples, like what's happened at the University, Berkeley Law School, UC Berkeley Law School, or the with the new museum in the in LA.
Was extraordinary. You know, I mean, Hollywood was a town, an industry that was invented by Jewish entrepreneurs back, you know, 100 or 90 years ago, and a new museum dedicated to exploring that history had an exhibit on diversity in Hollywood without once mentioning Jewish diversity. When this, of course, was pointed out, the museum scurried to find a permanent exhibit to, you know, people like Jack Warner and Louis Mayer and so on.
Goldwyn, yeah.
But the fact that it required public outrage to get there was extraordinarily telling, you know. And at Berkeley, a number of student organizations decided that they would not host any kind of Zionist speaker and would make this a litmus test. And the university, which wouldn't have stood for this for one second, if it came to another discriminated against group, is sort of twisting itself into knots over the free speech issues at play. My suggestion to Berkeley, for what it's worth, is they should absolutely accept the free speech principle that these organizations don't need to host Zionist speakers, and they should require that every speaker they do get sign a pledge which Berkeley Law School will post on its website saying, I adamantly reject Zionism and Israel and that apartheid state, so that law schools and judges offering clerkships can just see that posted in a public place, so that these militant anti-Zionists, what amounts to essentially a no Jewish Zionist policy, that they can be seen and heard in a way that has that goes beyond simply the question of the a speaking engagement at Berkeley.
So last week I was at an event for the Jewish Federation in New York City to do this annual gala, their big Wall Street event where they have leaders from finance and investment management sectors, investment banking, and a couple of them get honored each year. It's one of the biggest fundraisers for the New York City Jewish Federation, New York City Jewish organized Jewish community. And the keynote speaker was Van Jones, who you know worked in the Obama administration, who's a commentator on CNN, who's done a lot of work in on criminal justice reform, a leader in the black community. And he got up there and gave a speech, and he opened. It was sort of chilling. He says, "I'm here with an apology." That's what he said. "I'm here with an apology." And the apology he was making, according to him, you can find his speech, it's public. He says it's on behalf of my community for not speaking out after Kanye. He focused on Kanye, and on behalf of the media, which I'm a part of, he says, for not actually taking these issues seriously and not reporting on them as we should have. And he says that's about to change. Now, it was an impressive. His remarks, at least the beginning there, were impressive, and it was admirable that he said these things. But I thought to myself, that's great. I like Van. It's great that he's saying these things, but he's saying it to a big Jewish audience in New York City. Who's making this point to the media, decision makers in the media, mainstream media? Who's making this point to leaders in the black community? Like, is there a real effort? I know we're all talking about it and hand-wringing about it, but you know, this is a discussion that has to happen inside certain industries and inside certain communities, not just within our own.
Well, inside the media, I guess I am.
Yeah, so you're there. You're in the belly of the beast.
It's a point that I make repeatedly, and I think I wrote a long Sunday Review piece in the Times on
after that
pretty
cartoon.
Much exactly. Exactly. Well, actually, so I did it about the cartoon, and then I did it after the Colleyville hostage situation. The media, I think to some extent, this is a hypothetical, I may be wrong, but I think to some extent, a lot of Jewish media, people who are Jews who are leaders in their respective media organizations that think, well, we can't have a Jewish problem here in terms of our coverage because, you know, we're Jewish. And so we are immune from any charge of anti-Semitism. And no one is charging them with anti-Semitism. The question is, are we giving this the kind of attention that it needs, or are we in fact downplaying it because we somehow think it's less important than hate crimes being perpetrated against other groups? I don't know whether that's true or not, but I suspect there's at least some aspect there that's accurate. And as a result, you know, for years, the Hasidic community in Williamsburg and other areas of New York has been under attack, and very few people outside of those communities were aware of them. We just weren't reporting it. Or when the LA Times had this, I think it was, no, excuse me, it was another news organization, had a story about Jewish diners at a sushi restaurant in West Hollywood being assaulted.
During the Gaza War. During the May 21 Gaza War. Yeah.
Right. And the suggestion was, well, anger about the war just spilled over onto the streets.
Yeah, it was a KABC report. It was a local affiliate report. And it was, the line was, Mideast tensions lead to LA fight.
Yes, which is, it was, the Mideast tensions did not lead to the fight, and the fight was not a fight, it was an assault. And yet that's how it was reported. And you have to ask yourself, well,
right, so Jewish, you know, diners are eating sushi in L.A. They get attacked in like a mob attack, and this is which is really like a blatantly anti-Semitic attack, and the press covers it as Mideast tensions lead to L.A. fight.
I mean, it's unthinkable in other contexts. You know, white person upset about human rights situation in Ethiopia attacks. Black people in the United States. I mean, you know, it's absurd, and of course it would unthinkable too, but it's commonplace when it comes to discussing the Middle East vis-a-vis the safety of American Jews. So this is an issue, and as I said, I've repeatedly tried to call attention to the problematic way in which too much of the media reports it.
All right, Brett, we'll leave it there. I highly recommend the Sapir Journal, Ideas for a Thriving Jewish Future, which, again, we'll post on the show notes. And, as each issue comes out, there's always something you'll want to sink your teeth in. So maybe readers will. So, Brett, maybe we'll have you come back on again in the future to hit a future issue because it's like a discussion driver. And now I have more and more people pointing out essays to me. I'm like, you don't have to point out Sapir to me. I'm on it. So anyways, with that, thanks for coming on, and don't go to Russia.
No plans. Thank you very much, Jen.
That's our show for today. Be sure to look out tomorrow for a full episode, and also be sure to follow Sapir at sapirjournal.org, SAPIRGOURNAL. That's sapirjournal.org. Call Me Back is produced by Alon Benatar. Until next time, I'm your host, Dan Senor.